Good morning, everyone. I'd like to thank everybody for the opportunity to talk with you today. Okay. First, as requested, I have no relationships to disclose. The objectives of my talk and my study were to describe estimates of national testing rates for chlamydia in non-emergent ambulatory settings, and to describe whether the testing rates vary by selected patient level or provider and facility level practice factors. And I did this in two samples, in women without visits in the preceding 12 months and in those who reported symptoms. And thanks to Michelle that did a great introduction about chlamydial infection. I can sort of breeze through these slides. Again, it's a very common infection, the most common bacterial sexually transmitted infection. And Michelle had a great slide describing the sequelae, including pelvic inflammatory disease, infertility, chronic pelvic pain, and ectopic pregnancy, as well as some pregnancy-related, pregnancy-associated complications such as preterm labor and ruptured membranes and neonatal infection. This slide is from the CDC's Sexually Transmitted Disease Surveillance Program, and it illustrates the number of cases that have been reported. And as you can see, the vast majority of cases were in females and actually in non-STD clinic settings. This next graph, also from the STD surveillance from the CDC, shows the difference in chlamydia infection rates by race and ethnicity. By race and ethnicity. And as you can see, the rates are higher in blacks, American Indian and Alaska Native populations, and also in the Hispanic population. And this, again, is just highlighting the very high prevalence in young women, particularly those aged 15 to 25. Sorry, I'm trying to use the cursor. There we go. And these two very long red bars here, where the prevalence is over 3%, or where more than 3,000 cases were reported per 100,000 population. And again, as was mentioned earlier, most infections are asymptomatic, up to 75% in women, and actually up to 95% in men. Because of this asymptomatic nature and because screening has been shown to reduce sequelae, a number of organizations recommend screening on an annual basis. The U.S. Preventative Services Task Force recommends screening sexually active women under age 24 and under, and the CDC and the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology recommend screening sexually active women under age 25. There's also a HEDIS measure for health plan evaluation, which assesses the proportion of sexually active females in a health plan between the ages of 15 and 25 who have been screened for chlamydial infection annually. So with this background, for the study I'm presenting today, I used two data sources. And basically, these are two surveys that are part of the CDC's National Health Statistics family of healthcare surveys. One is the National Ambulatory Medical Care Survey, or NAMCS, and the second is the National Hospital Ambulatory Medical Care Survey, or HAMCS. And I used the four most recent years of data available, 2005 to 2008. The NAMCS and HAMCS data were weighted to produce national estimates. And again, 4 years of data were used, were combined to produce more reliable estimates. For some background on the NAMCS, it's a nationally representative survey of visits to non-federal office-based physicians and providers in community health centers. The basic sampling unit for the NAMCS is the physician office visit in which medical services are provided. So out-of-scope visits include administrative visits such as those used to pay bills or to drop off specimens. The HAMCS is also a nationally representative survey of visits to hospital emergency departments, outpatient departments, and ambulatory surgery centers. It has three components. In-scope hospitals for the survey include non-institutional, general, and short stay. And by short stay, I mean those with a mean length of stay of under 30 days. So it does not include federal, military, or Veterans Administration facilities. And in my particular study, I used the outpatient department, or OPD, component of the NAMCS. This component is the counterpart to the physician office-based survey, or the NAMCS, in hospitals. Both these surveys collect, although they're slightly different from each other, they collect similar data items and are designed similarly to allow users to compare data from each setting. They contain patient-level information as well as some facility and provider-level information. And as listed, some of the patient items are the demographic information, such as age, race, ethnicity, some data elements related to continuity of care, reason for visit, diagnoses, diagnostic and screening services provided, and medications. Some facility and provider items include practice or facility locality and provider clinic specialty. In describing our study, I'll begin with some of the definitions I used. First of all, I didn't use all visits to offices. I used those to primary care office or clinics. And in the NAMCIS, or the Physician Office Survey, there's a data element that identifies primary care physicians with primary care specialties, including those in general internal medicine, general pediatrics, family practice, family medicine, and general OBGYN. And in the OPD component of the HAMCIS, I included visits from clinics with specialties of similarly general internal medicine, general pediatrics, general practice family medicine, and general obstetrics and gynecology. Chlamydia testing was identified by a checkbox on the survey indicating that chlamydia testing was ordered or provided during the visit. Sexually active women were identified by reason for visit, ICD-9 CM diagnosis codes, use of contraceptive medication, and certain survey variables. Those reasons for visit and ICD-9 CM codes associated with pregnancy, contraception, sexually transmitted infections, and infertility were included, or classified women as being sexually active. In addition, those visits with pregnancy testing and PAP testing were also included. Additionally, I identified two samples to approximate an annual visit by women in my particular age group. I identified there's a data item on both surveys that indicates the number of visits the woman had to the provider in the past 12 months, and I included those with a visit of zero, or number zero. Additionally, there's a checkbox on the survey form that asked whether the patient had been seen before in this clinic or office, and those with no were included. To identify women with symptoms, these were done by either the reason for visit variable or the diagnosis variable. And again, those that had reasons for visit that included pelvic pain, symptoms of pelvic infection, postcoital bleeding, vaginal discharge, or painful urination were included. And those that had diagnosis codes associated with inflammatory diseases of the female pelvic organs, vaginal discharge, postcoital bleeding, lower abdominal pain or tenderness, and dysuria, urethral discharge, or urgency. Other factors I examined were age, categorized as either 15 through 19 or 20 through 25. Race, white versus black. A small sample size limited the evaluation or assessment of other categories. Ethnicity, Hispanic versus non-Hispanic. Payment source, private, Medicaid, and SCHIP, or self-pay. And some provider and facility level data elements, such as setting, whether it was in a physician office or hospital-based outpatient department, geographic region, and physician or clinic specialty, categorized as OBGYN versus other primary care specialties. Again, the analysis was relatively simple. I had two samples, as I'd noted. Women in the age group of 15 to 25 who had no previous visits in the past year, and those in the same age group who reported symptoms. I calculated the percentage of eligible visits with chlamydia testing ordered or provided, and statistical significance was determined using Pearson's chi-square test with a level of significance set at p less than 0.05. And again, estimates with a sample size of 30 or less or a relative standard error of 30 or greater did not meet CDC standards of reliability or precision. Moving on to the findings. There were approximately 50 million visits on an average annual basis by women of age 15 through 25 to primary care offices or clinics. And about half of them, or 45%, were classified as being bisexually active females. among women with no visits in the preceding year, there were about 10 million visits on average annually. And about 41% were classified as bisexually active females. Chlamydia testing was performed in about 17% of these visits. Excuse me. This graph shows the percentage of visits in which chlamydia testing was reported in the sample of women who had no preceding visit in the past year. Again, on the top bar shows the overall testing rate, and the patient level factors are on this particular graph, including age, race, ethnicity, and payment source. And again, although it appears that the rates are not exactly the same, there was no statistically significant difference between any of these patient level factors. This is a similar graph showing chlamydia testing rates with provider facility level factors. Again, there was no statistically significant difference in region or by provider clinic specialty. However, there was a higher rate of chlamydia testing in hospital outpatient departments compared to physician offices. And you can see 27.3 versus 15.7. In my second sample, are the women with symptoms. There are approximately 1.3 million average annual visits by women aged 15 to 25 with symptoms of chlamydia infection. And approximately 82% of these were bisexually active women. And chlamydia testing was performed in 29% of these visits. Now, this first graph shows the testing, the testing rate in this group of women by the patient factors. Again, age, race, ethnicity, and payment source. And there was no statistically significant difference by age, race, ethnicity, or payment source. However, you'll notice that the overall testing rate at 29.3% is greater than the overall testing rate in the other sample of women that had no previous visit in the past 12 months. This next graph shows the testing rate by provider facility factors, specifically setting or physician office versus OPD. In this particular group, although the testing rate was higher, it was not statistically significant. And also, there was no statistically significant difference by region as well. Now, the strengths of this study and these data sources are that they're nationally representative and give a good view of overview of provider practice. These data are abstracted from medical records and not from claims data, so clinical data elements are available. And also, it can look at those women that are uninsured. Having said that, there are several limitations, one being that it's visit-based data. And I attempted to extrapolate or approximate patient-based data by limiting the sample to the first visit in 12 months. Additionally, it's a cross-sectional study design, so we couldn't track patients longitudinally over a year. As well, the estimates of visits by sexually active females could possibly be low due to the indirect method of identification by reason for visit and diagnosis and medications and tests that were ordered cross-sectionally. It's possible that at later visits, they might have diagnoses codes or reasons for visit that might identify them as being sexually active. Visits to other providers were not available. The data elements in both surveys ask if the visit, if there were any previous visits to that particular provider. It is possible that the patient could have seen another provider earlier. Again, selected data elements were available. I could not examine other risk factors for sexually transmitted infections, such as number of partners or use of condoms. And additionally, sample size limited the analysis of provider specialty and symptomatic women, and also the use of, or to the assessment of factors such as metropolitan statistical area in both samples. And in conclusion, there appear to be more frequent testing in hospital-based clinics compared to provider physician offices in women with no previous visits in the past year. And however, this testing did not vary by other patient level or provider facility level factors studied. The testing rates were higher in symptomatic women. And again, the testing rates didn't vary by patient or provider level factors studied. Overall, the chlamydia testing rate was low. Over 80% of the visits in women who hadn't had a visit in the past year had no testing recorded, and over 70% of the women who reported symptoms had no testing recorded. Chlamydia testing wasn't performed in the majority of the eligible visits, and regardless of the selected patient or provider facility factors examined. And that concludes my presentation. I thank you for your attention.
So the question is about patients who we refer to continuity, ongoing continuity, and then how many of them transition. So we did an original study where we actually looked at that, and a lot of our, where we actually to develop this program, we had a R01 to actually develop it, and the majority of patients transitioned within 4 months. But we have not tracked that for our patients here now. We do have a way of looking through our hospital system to look at chlamydia, gonorrhea, pregnancy ascertainment for those who are seen either in our clinic or in the hospital system. But since it's a regional STD program, you can't really know that. So it's hard to know what people do. I'm sorry. I wish we did.
Yes, that's going to be part of the third phase where the patient gets to choose how they would like to be reminded for retest. And one of the options would be that they could choose to get a home test sent to them, or they could pick it up at the clinic if they didn't feel that it would be safe to have it sent at home.
How much is it?
How much is a home test? That is a very good question that I'm not really sure. It's usually covered through Family Pact, the Medi-Cal waiver that we have in California. So I'm not too sure about the price, but I know that it's going out through the state control, the state laboratory. So I could find out that information for you, though. That's a great question. Thank you.
I have a question for you. I think that you may have been a little bit late, but I saw a slide on sustainability, and I saw that you have some private funding and also federal funding. I guess I want to know what's the percentage between the two of you, though, and how do you
The question relates to sustainability and funding. So we actually have Title 10 dollars, which are, as any federal dollars, are fairly stable, and so we'll continue to get them. Colorado did have an infusion of some anonymous donor dollars, which we used and then developed some of our IUD and implant insertion things. What we're going to try and do is actually hopefully be able to continue with the Title 10 and enhancement of Title 10, since a lot of our patients are not people that would necessarily go to primary care providers for initial services, and then we can get them on services. But we do have a core amount of money from Title 10, as well as STD control, federal, state, local dollars that we then bridge all of those together. The other question is, of course, whether, and this will come up, I think, is whether you bill through Medicaid and those kinds of things and develop it. And I think we have to study that to figure out a way, if that's possible, in an STD program, whether that could be a sustainable way of doing it. There's a lot of caveats involved, and we've seen that STD testing goes down when you have a fee and you put barriers up for patients. So we'll have to look into that, and that's my next grant. So the question relates to the time required and also what's required in regard to a comprehensive family planning visit. So there's something called in Title 10 a delayed exam. And really, if you think about it, family planning, to start birth control, you do not have to have a comprehensive exam. It's a misnomer to think that you have to do that. And it also causes people to not go out with birth control because there's all these barriers to starting birth control. It can be done over the course of the year. And family planning doesn't need all the other things that you're describing. There should be something done once a year for any woman who's on contraception, a complete exam and all of those things. But to start birth control, you don't need to do that. And so we don't. We use the delayed exam methodology to start people on it, and then they get comprehensive care. We'll do it if they're part of our continuity program, blood pressure is all a complete exam focused on reproductive health that's a little different from the STD program. We don't do immunizations except Hep A and Hep B in our clinic, and those are for high-risk people that sort of justify that. But I understand, I think you have to work with your Title 10 people and talk about the issues, and they're different from family planning clinics versus STD programs. I think there's some variations.
And just going off of that, with our program, or the California Family Health Council, we have really great forums. We try to highlight best practices in California through the Title 10 family planning programs. So we have clinical forums and things like that that are on our website that are free and downloadable on a Word document. So if you wanted to look at those and take a look and fit them for your clinic's needs. But we also really try to do trainings where we talk to clinics about incorporating standing orders for, MAs or, people at the front desk to be able to do some of the history or intake and things like that. That would kind of make the whole process more efficient when they do finally see the provider. So if you have any more questions about that, I'd be happy to give you my card.
Other questions?
Oh, I have one.
Yeah.
About your EMR use, how important was that, do you think, to the actual your program? And was it a new thing that you had put in place for the program, or had the electronic?
So the question relates to the electronic medical record. So in 2005, I think, is when we created the electronic medical record for the STD program, and a lot of it had to do with reporting purposes, and so it was an initial document. It was not very user-friendly initially, and it's evolved over time, and so it's now poised to be able to provide those prompts and things that we just, there's other prompts that we have in there too, expedited partner therapy, there's a prompt to make sure that if somebody's eligible, you can do that. There's other prompts that are necessary. We haven't prompted for repeat chlamydia testing, but I did write that down as another idea. So I think there's things, but the EMR is something that we did, actually, we used it, some preparedness dollars to help us develop it.
So it was in place.
Oh, yes, yes. It started in 2006, and probably if somebody was here from our team that was involved, that they could tell you the exact date. But it's very helpful to have an electronic medical record, so then you can actually QA all the things that you need to do much easier.
All right. Well, if there's not any more questions,